This podcast brought to you by TechSmith. More A3 is software that helps you see things from your customer's point of view, so you can make things that are truly fast, powerful, and easy to use. By Blackbaud, making the world a better place by providing technology solutions and support to nonprofit organizations around the world. By OptimalSort, with an elegant user interface, powerful analysis, and outstanding support, OptimalSort can help you run card sorts better than you ever thought possible. By PowerMapper, mapping your site has never been easier. PowerMapper extracts links from each page of your site until it's mapped your entire site, providing you with a complete inventory. By Acture, enabling information architects and user experience professionals to design efficiently, experience their designs, and clearly communicate them, ensuring more useful and usable applications. And by Boxes and Arrows. Since 2001, Boxes and Arrows has been a peer-written journal promoting contributors who want to provoke thinking, push limits, and teach a few things along the way. For other events happening all over the world, be sure and check out events.boxesandarrows.com. The design of a park around a museum of biodiversity in Panama, designed by Frank Gehry, has inspired a number of collaborations and connections throughout Panama and now the United States. The park will be a living extension of the museum's exhibits and the first step in an educational trial that will encourage visitors to explore Panama's rich natural resources. In this presentation, author and landscape designer Edwina Van Gaal discusses how this project has inspired her to become more involved in other educational and applied projects in Panama, working with scientists, students, and local populations to explore sustainable alternatives in agriculture, architecture, and tourism. I hope everyone enjoys the podcast. Cheers.
So the story starts in Panama. And Panama is a very small country. It's about the size, a little bit smaller than South Carolina. Can everybody hear me all right? Can you? Is it possible to turn that light down a little bit? But in spite of its small size, it's second in the world in biodiversity to the Amazon basin. And the reason for that is its incredible diversity of geography, actually, so that affords the existence of many different kinds of ecosystems. And so there's mountains, and there's a lot of seashore, and there's the Pacific and the Caribbean. And it's something of course, a paradise, but as all places in paradise in today's world, it's troubled, so that the mangroves are being cut for civilization to march on. And everywhere you look now in Panama, because of its high level of beauty, once again, it's the old killing the goose for the golden egg. What will be left when is it going to tip the balance, which is what we're looking at all over the world. So Panama makes an incredibly perfect microcosm of ecological and environmental challenges everywhere in the world. And so our story will begin in Panama City. That's the Isthmus of Panama. Colombia's on the right, on the east side, and Costa Rica's on the left, the west side. One of the things that surprises people is that Panama runs east-west, and it's directly due south from New York City, same time zone. So when people say the Panama Canal actually runs from the northwest to the southeast, it really, you watch people kind of trying to adjust their brains, and but that's why. So Panama City has a lovely old section that is actually protected. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And it's got the downtown, which it was originally one of the first places where tropical architecture was responsive to climate. It was before air conditioning. Since air conditioning came in, the tropical architecture just kind of glassed in, and since electricity was cheap, nobody really worried about it. And now, this is the site of the old El Panama Hotel, which was one of the first great examples of tropical modernist architecture. And stuff is just popping up. This is smack in the middle of the city. There are buildings shooting up everywhere. And since Panama's so small, you may ask, why is this happening there? And the answer is this. And this is the Panama Canal. not what most people thought, really, because the Panama Canal is actually largely a lake, which was formed by making a dam and then raising the water level to a point that ships could navigate across the isthmus. And then they put locks at either end, which are fed by fresh water. And the need for sufficient fresh water to feed the locks is met by the Chagres River and the abundant rainfall. But it has also been the magnet for an unbelievably large amount of scientific investigation, at which is now spread out throughout the neotropics because of increasing rainforest awareness about the critical role that rainforest and freshwater supplies play. So here is what the canal actually looks like when it looks more like a canal. These are in the foreground is the Miraflores locks and then the Pedro Miguel locks beyond and then on into the distance across the isthmus. This is actually looking north. And this is looking south, and there's there's the city of Panama, and this is the canal. This is the Bridge of the Americas, and we're about to zoom in on that spot right there. And here it is again. This little strip of land was made available when the canal zone reverted from the United States back to Panama in 1999. A lot of people realized that what Panama was actually getting was a lot of extraordinary real estate, and because the United States had held most of it to protect the canal, but it wasn't necessary that it be that much used for military purposes. And so one of the things was that because Frank Gehry's wife is Panamanian, a group of Panamanians hired Frank to do some master planning for all of the canal zone properties. Well, they started out very grand within their thinking, but in the end, for the moment, it scaled down to building one museum on this site. And part of the beauty of this site is that it's very similar to the Sydney Opera House in the way it relates to the city. It's right there. You have the Bay of Panama on one side. This is Casco Viejo, the old part of the city. This is the canal. And this actually is a very popular place. This causeway goes out to a few islands that are used heavily for recreational purposes. Everybody rides bikes and walks on the causeway. And so it was the perfect place for an institution that was going to be dedicated towards raising the consciousness of the Panamanian people about the treasure they had in their incredible environmental richness and how to create an institution that would also try to bring them into a state of mind that would hopefully protect this incredible wealth. When all kinds of, I guess you would say there was all kinds of temptation to go the other way, which is generally the case. And so the museum is being built. I happened to get involved because I had a small job with Frank Gehry's office in the past, but I'm a primarily plant-based designer. And so this was, as they had always said, someday there'll be the job for you. And so Frank had always designed mostly in urban context, and once I kind of made a really... I said something about at Bilbao about who put those horrible planters all around Bilbao, and Frank said I did, and so then I was kind of stuck making up for it, and so because we did get into a conversation about how the spaces around a lot of the urban buildings were not terribly user-friendly, and how he and his office were constrained in so many cases by the fact that the exterior would be handled by another company that was working independently from his office, and the exhibition spaces inside the museum were working with companies that were also hired independent of his office, so he was required to make spaces that could be retrofitted in both cases. And so because he could call the shots on this job, it had a relatively much smaller budget than anything he would ordinarily take on, he got to say who would be the landscape designer and who would be the exhibit designer, and he hired two people who were not exactly to be expected, myself and Bruce Mau. Bruce Mau is a graphic designer, and this would have been, was his first foray into three dimensions. So the idea was to create an information system that would speak to people on many different levels, because we have many different audiences who will come to the park and to the museum. And because but those of you who know Bruce, and you all surely know Frank, and so I have come to think of the project as extra small, large, and extra large. And I guess that flew. Anyway, it's kind of a graphic joke. Bruce did a book about Rem Koolhaas called Small, Medium, Large, Extra Large. And so the idea of the museum then was that we would all work together. The design concept was that we would design everything together. So we all convened in the Gary Partners' offices on a regular basis to design a building and a space around it and the exhibits inside that would be completely expressive of the story. And what's the story? So we needed, they had come up with a really great tale to tell, which is the tale of Panama, so it isn't exactly as if it was invented. One of the great backbones upon which we could do this is that Panama is the home for the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute called STRI. And they immediately became our partner and my science advisory team. And we were focusing on the Isthmus of Panama. And the way you can see the way it's arranged, it was the final link in creating the connection between North and South America. South America was once part of Asia, Gondwanaland, and drifted across. And over time, the space began to silt up and eventually connected the two continents and at the same time divided the two oceans. And as a result, it changed the climate of the year. It warmed northern Europe sufficiently for human habitation. It created civilization as we know it now, if you want to start from that point. So this is a big matter of pride for Panamanians, and it's also endlessly interesting for scientists in many different ways. So the building, you can see kind of right from the start, the design of the building is reflecting that. And the circulation of the building is somewhat derivative of this great biological interchange that happened between North and South America. This is a good reason for, also one of the underlying reasons for the tremendous biological diversity in Panama, is that you had species coming from the south, species coming from the north, and meeting there. You had later ice age coming down, bringing northern plants that were far more cold tolerant, and then receding and leaving many of them behind in the higher elevations that adjusted sufficiently over time to become tropical plants. And so here's the museum in the context of the park. You can see that the museum kind of explodes out into the park. The elements of the park are designed to reflect what's going on inside the museum. The museum is split up into a series of different exhibits, of course. The design of the exhibits is embedded in the design of the architecture. This is the upper floor and the lower floor. And then the park is designed to have little places all around, we're calling them information stations, all around the park that will carry this message on out. One of the things that was really important to us in the design of the park, a few things, one of which was that the park be free. completely barrier-free. So there's no, everybody assumed that there would have to be a fence around the park. There will not be a fence around the park. The park will be open 24/7, and it will be totally free. So anyone who comes to the museum one time can return to the park on a regular basis. The other thing that Bruce did was he wrote a design manifesto for everything, so actually going back. So all of the colors, all of the typefaces, all of the graphic representation that's used throughout the project will always refer back to Bruce's design principles for the project. When you first enter, the first thing that you'll come to is the Gallery of Biodiversity, because it's the big story. And it's interesting how prescient it's proving to be, because beyond climate change, preservation of biodiversity is really the environmental issue, as Michael Friedman said, is that we might have very clean air with a very dead planet at this rate. So it's our big message. And so the park will be the first step out of the museum. The theme song of the museum is Panama is the Museum, so that everything in the museum is directed towards really getting people to go out and experience it, the real thing in nature. Panamanians are not, and I found this throughout tropical countries actually, they're not real outdoor people. And so that typically the jungle was to be feared. The jungle's a scary place. Panama's sort of jungle light. It's not that, there's not a lot of dangerous stuff there, but you certainly wouldn't want to spend a night lost in the Darien. I mean, it would be really scary. So there are places throughout the park that represent what's going on in the museum. So biodiversity, for instance, we have an area of palms and cycads, which express, for instance, you know, the monocots versus dicots. There will be a grotto, which is formed of gabions that are dripping with epiphytes. And then you can take that out into the world. The closest big park is right on the edge of Panama City, which is the Parque Metropolitano. It's sort of the central park of Panama. It also expresses very clearly one of the reasons why Panama is and has been such a popular place for rainforest science, because it's right there. You can go into the rainforest and you can go home for lunch, and then you can go back out and do some more research. So when scientists who are used to often living under really, really scuzzy conditions in collecting, I mean, not that they don't have to still sometimes, but this was where the first canopy crane was built to study the rainforest canopy. It was right there, and it's pretty funny. It's still there, and you'll be driving along the highway, and there it is. You know, I thought it was somewhere out in the middle of, but then you realize, well, you can't really drive a crane into the rainforest, and you can't maintain a crane, so this is so perfect. Then building the bridge is how Panama was formed geologically, and how through sedimentation and plate tectonics and everything that the land kind of collided and popped up. And we're working on developing a series of, I guess what I would call, like, comfortable associations throughout the park. My preference always in landscape, my design ethic is that to create landscapes that give you a heightened awareness of the beauty of the various elements of a plant, and maybe raise your curiosity a little bit about why is that plant like that, but at the same time doing it in an atmosphere of serenity and calm. And that doesn't, how do we do that in a park with the smallest amount of signage? Because I think that signage really interferes with that kind of relationship with the plants. And when you go into a real forest, there may not be signs. And so how do we start raising people's consciousness without hitting them over the head with it? How to send subtle messages? And one of the ways is, I think, to use elements from everyday life from the recognizable Panamanian landscape for people. So one of them, showing how the building itself sort of represents this collision of North and South America and the tectonic plates. It just kind of... And so out in the countryside, there are all these erratics. An erratic is a rock that just appears in the landscape, generally left by a glacier or some occurrence in the past that stripped away the soil and left the rocks. And these are commonly seen all in all the pastures around. And so what we want to do is that these will be used as the site furniture. Basically, people will sit on rocks and hopefully think about, oh, these are the rocks. Then they go back out into the countryside and they see the rocks differently. It's all about how, when you go out into nature, will you look at something as you have never looked at it before. The Oceans Divided is going to be, of course, the big scene stealer, because that's Aquaria and everyone loves an aquarium. So the way it's expressed on the outside is very clear, the big yellow tanks. And there'll be two of them, the Atlantic and the Pacific. And then out in the park, we're going to have a small mangrove tank, which is based on your classic Panamanian horse or cattle trough, which that you see in every field, just about. But down the road, since we don't want to duplicate amenities that already exist in Panama, right down the causeway is a marine facility that mostly serves the children of Panama that's run by STRI in an old army bunker. But it's a really magnificent site. This is a school group looking for limpets on the rocks. It was commandeered by Noriega, has a really great romantic history. Sort of, he used to play cards out on this point. It's one of the most beautiful little spots in Panama. And it's a good thing STRI has it. It's under siege by developers who would really like to get it, but STRI is holding on. And the Worlds Collide is when it's about the interchange. Animals coming from North America and animals coming from South America. The interchange, same thing, moving through the museum. The animals aren't really moving the same way as they used to. but this picture was taken right down the road from the park. So although most of my focus would appear to be on plants, the plants are the magnet for the animals. And there is a wild animal recovery program in Panama, and we hope that we will be able to fill the park with a sufficient number of species that will indeed be happy there and be able to thrive. The plant selection for the park is based on that what will grow there is what would be growing there. We're not going to try to replicate ecosystems that do not exist in the vicinity of Panama City. And I have a couple reasons for that. One, it would be way too labor intensive, not sustainable. The other one is I don't like to give people the impression that you can simply create or recreate an ecosystem. I mean, this place is trashed right now. You know, it's completely destroyed, the entire site. It has been for some time. It was a golf course before. So to just do a sort of a pop-up fake ecosystem, a fake environment, it never really would be real, and to pretend that it is, especially such a small patch of one, I think is misleading. We really want to get people to go out and see what a true... This is a dry coastal forest. It's actually deciduous a good deal of the time. There are a large part of the summer time, which is actually it's December, January, February, March, when a lot of the trees lose their leaves. And it doesn't look like what a lot of people would assume a tropical, lush place would look. So what I'm trying to do is to create instances where people will find how to make this appeal to people, how to encourage people that native plants could be maybe worth considering for their own gardens, for their own landscapes. And our link for this section will be to the Summit Garden, which is not far out of Panama City. It was originally created, actually, to test Southeast Asian plants for gardens related to people moving in for the canal building. And it now is going to revert primarily to a native plant garden. They also have endangered species and representative species of animals from Panama. But it's a strange, otherworldly kind of place, which I also find tremendously engaging, that it really sort of represents a piece of Panama's past. And it does, this is a bamboo that is not Panamanian, so it's, I think it's also an opportunity, because you want to teach people the both sides of the coin. We're not going to use non-Panamanian plants in the park, but it's interesting for at Summit to see why the non-Panamanian plants were brought into the country and what effect they have had on the ecosystem there. The human path traces the movement of mankind across the Bering Strait, down through Panama to South America. That it's under the building, actually, right under there. So because you come down out of the section and you walk under the building and through and up. There are many plants that were brought down by mankind throughout the Americas, and some of them are of particular interest, this one being Bixa orellana, which is used in coloring margarine. It's a red dye. And so there, as much as possible, this is the ethnobotanical section of the park, which will be devoted to the plants of Panama that have economic importance throughout the world. And actually, we have broken down a little bit and included a few plants that are not Panamanian, but that were brought into Panama by early settlers, early slaves, and that have become so much a part of the Panamanian vocabulary that people don't realize. One of the great, I think, Panamanian fruits, this is a cashew. And everyone who comes to Panama who goes around with us is so fascinated by the cashew, I had to put it in here, because every fruit, this is actually not a fruit, it's a swollen pedicel, but it is edible. But that little thing at the bottom, that's a cashew nut. Every cashew nut that you pop in by the handfuls was individually roasted and clean, you know, harvested, cleaned, and roasted. So when you wonder why they're so darned expensive, you begin to understand. They are also highly toxic. You cannot eat them until they're properly roasted. And so in terms of all of, and they grow on the roadsides everywhere, so it's a very familiar message for Panamanians to bring in things to make them comfortable in this space. Another very familiar message is the living fences that grow, that are used throughout Panama, because typically wood would rot very quickly for fence posts, so what they use is stakes cut from trees, and they're stuck in the ground. They root. They grow more stakes, which are harvested every 2 to 3 years off the tops, and they're stuck in the ground. And so you have this constant regenerative, sustainable fence line that also acts as a sort of mini biological corridor for quite a few species. And another thing that will be incorporated into this part of the park will be a tradition, some traditional Panamanian architecture, I hope. We can just, like, we have to see what Gary's office comes up with for this part. But this is my inspiration. It's bamboo and thatch. Then this, we will link out to some of Panama's very interesting archaeological sites. Most people don't realize, or even in Panama, I don't think they realize what a very rich past Panama has, because they didn't do any building that has remained. But the grave sites have yielded unbelievable riches, much of which exists in the Smithsonian in Washington in their vaults, and is being somewhat excavated, I guess you'd say, for the museum, although the museum will use copies because of the openness of the museum, the security, having security to house real artifacts would really ruin the feeling of the museum. So, but this is a place called El Caño. There were sculptures on all of these posts, which are now mostly at the Smithsonian, and nobody knows what it was supposed to be. It's being excavated now. Nobody knows what kind of ceremonies or what dictated this arrangement. And the Living Web is really the culmination of everything, which is speaks to the unbelievable complexities of nature, that everything interreacts with everything else, and such an amazingly complex and perfectly engineered way. The ficus tree, this ficus tree is about the only thing on the site, well, it is the only plant on the site that we're going to keep from before. It doesn't even happen to be a Panamanian native, but because it's so big and because the story of the ficus, which is a fig tree, the fig and the wasp, there are hundreds of different fig species, and every one of them has a wasp, its own species of wasp that pollinates it. And the fig flower is actually inside the fruit, so when you pop open a fig and you see all those little dots inside, those are actually stamens. That's actually a flower inside. And the wasps go inside and they lose their wings, the females do, they lay their eggs. There's a complex relationship, and it's a long story, but that will be told in the park, and or in the museum and in the park. And so we're designing a kind of a spiral walkway that will take people up into the tree to experience it and all the other interactions that are happening in the tree. Another part of the story of the web is the role that fresh water plays. You got a little idea of that from the canal. And when I first suggested that I wanted to do stormwater capture and keep a lot of fresh water in the park, on the original committee was a guy who had been in charge of vector control for the Panama Canal. And he said, absolutely not. You're going to have mosquitoes. And his idea of a mosquito was, the only good mosquito is a dead mosquito. We should absolutely eradicate mosquitoes, that there should not be a mosquito left on the earth. And I said, so we had a little difference of opinion. But in the end, because I was arguing for the fact that, regardless, Panama's economy is based on a constant supply of fresh water. And people have got to understand what a healthy relationship with water is, as opposed to a vector-ridden relationship. And it is very interesting, because a lot of people don't realize that only domestic mosquitoes carry disease, and there's a difference between domestic mosquitoes and wild mosquitoes. And it's another big story. So we have all of these stories to tell in the park, which will be done starting by creating spaces that house the plants that tell the stories. And then this section of the park will reach out to the Rainforest Discovery Center, which is just outside of Panama, in another one of its nearby rainforests, which is actually on Pipeline Road. Pipeline Road is famous to birdwatchers, and it's one of the preeminent birdwatching sites of the world. And this is a tower they've built where you can go up and look out over the rainforest. This is the plan, and Jorge had referred to this immense plant list. The plant list is huge. The idea is to try to represent the plants. We will whittle it down a lot, most likely, because there's only so many plants we can represent. And then the question is signage. What do you do? Do you put a sign on every one of those trees? I'm kind of not for it, because I'd like to stay with this feeling of tranquility. We will, but so that's where we have to come up with an idea. Do we build some kind of code in that you could get on your cell phone that would tell you the name of the tree? Because what percentage of the people who come to the park really need to know the name of that tree? And signage is all either highly scientific or a little bit romantic. This means a death full of life. It's a stump in a national park, but you could get cute and do signs all over, and I think it kind of, this was in this place that was completely remote. It was like a dinosaur was coming out, and I came upon the sign. I didn't know whether I should laugh or be offended, that it was there. But so how do you get plants to talk to people and tell their story? And in addition to signage, I'm very keen on promoting the idea of an oral tradition for the park. So what we hope to do is have every day a kind of story for the day. So someone at a specific time every day will be there telling a story that the plants and animals and an interaction that's happening in the park that day. But maybe that's another thing. Maybe in terms of the information, the architecture of the information, we'll find a way that you could do it on your cell phone. The great thing is that even, as you all know, even in undeveloped countries or underdeveloped, Panama is quite sophisticated in terms of its infrastructure, which was built by the United States. So not that we're so great, but they do have a lot of infrastructure electronically. And so that everybody's got a cell phone. And whereas maybe 10 years ago, we couldn't have even considered trying to create an architectural information base with electronics, now it seems pretty inevitable. And so the fact that the museum is taking a long time to build is in many ways in our favor, because we, as the technology grows, people's ability to access that technology is also growing. And so in terms of, I mean, there's something in the world of environmental preservation that's called a charismatic megafauna. And charismatic megafauna is your target species for fundraising, so like a panda or some really cute thing. So I, however, promote charismatic megaflora, which is so you can you know, so and the, so the megaflora is the one with the brightest flowers, of course. And so it's easy to kind of build a park or build a landscape based on bright flowers, but they're only there for a short amount of time. And this is the Guayacan, and it blooms bright yellow, but most of the rest of the year, it's a pretty boring, scraggly-looking tree. And so how do you try to create interest with a landscape without signs, and also build in the fact that when this landscape goes in, it's going to be tiny, because there are no nurseries in Panama where I can dial up mature native plants. It's just not going to happen. And so I need to build a story around it that will be somehow mixed into the experience before people even come to the museum. How do we get the story out that this is going to be like a baby? You know, if you were seeing a baby for the first time, you'd think it was all out of scale. But you're tuned to recognizing babies as cute. So how do we inform people that this very diminutive landscape is cute, and it's going to grow, and it's going to be their opportunity to watch it grow and grow along with it. So heliconias are one of the best known plants of Panama, so that clearly will rely to a certain extent on bright colored flowers, but everybody's seen them before. I mean, everybody uses them, so that that people have become completely blind to flowers like this. You think, oh, wow, but it really doesn't do the trick. What I want to get people to do is look at this. You know, this is something I picked up from the forest floor. It's minuscule, but I have this new camera. I could zoom in on it, and it's amazing. And how do you, and what about the story of this? This is a palm tree in bloom. These are the male flowers. Palms are in the grass family. They're monocots. They're grasses like bamboo. And they're just very big grasses. But they're also dioecious, which means the male and the female blooms have, they're separate male and female blooms. These are the male. And this is the female, because the female is making the palm fruits. But I find them extraordinarily beautiful. And when I point them out to people who were just charging right by without noticing, they say, wow. You know, so building in this thing, how do we hit people over the head with these kind of things? How do you make people stop and notice the beauty of, don't clean up the flowers as they fall to the ground. You know, try to keep your park maintenance maybe a little bit less rigid. Not that that will really be a problem, but just that, you know, celebrating the way nature actually displays itself, and not it being not our idea of how it should do it. And getting people to crawl around on their hands and knees, you know, looking at the small stuff. And what the heck is that? It's actually a casing for cicada. They nest under the ground. And getting up close, this is a palm trunk, and this is a trunk of a bombacaceae, and the peeling bark. These are all very common trees in Panama, but how many times do people walk past them without noticing? So what we want to do is make them notice. Throw it right down in your path. You have to walk over it, or you have to walk under it, or you have to walk through it, so that your relationship is specialized and the plants are in masses. They don't really occur this way in the wild, but we're massing them. It's a way of creating an information blast. So we're trying to reach out to people and trying to figure all these ways to reach the people. So the first person that got reached was me. And I realized somewhat afterwards that I fell victim to my own salesmanship or whatever, because I was working with the Smithsonian, and they asked me to go out and meet with a Panamanian landowner about a reforestation project in the Azuero Peninsula, which is an older part. It's three times as old geologically as the rest of Panama. And it is a bit different. This is the way it looks in the rainy season. This is the way it looks in the dry season. So it's a very harsh kind of environment. It is beautiful, though. But what makes it look like this is farming, because it used to be all forest a long time ago. It should be forest. I mean, it would have been forest. And that haze you see is burning, slash and burn. And this is what you get. And it's the reason for it, mostly in the Azuero, is cattle. And this is the result. The cattle, the amount of compaction that the cattle's hooves cause on the land make it almost impossible for the land to be reforested. I mean, it works, but it really impacts the land to the point where it's slowly wearing out. The farmers know it's wearing out, and they're running fewer and fewer head of cattle per hectare. So some people are turning to planting teak, but teak is a monoculture and supports no biodiversity. This is a burned area. Okay, I have to stop. So if anybody's interested to know about the stuff we're doing out on the Azuero, I will be around tomorrow. You can ask me.